Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I miss you. What's good, Internet? It is August 28th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 92. It's going to be a quick one this week. I'm Austin Walker, joining me, Patrick Klepek. Hey, Patrick.
You've been doing TV stuff, Mr. TV, man.
I've been doing TV stuff. Danielle's been doing TV stuff. I think she's in recovery from TV stuff. She was doing it. The thing that happened today was, like, so we had to come in really early to do it. We're just going to knock it out in the morning. No big deal. And then the morning moved into, like, late morning and then, like, early afternoon. And I was about to do my, like, second or third throw. So what I'm doing is the beginning of TV shows that have kind of hosts, what you'll see often is they'll say, like, hey, welcome to Waypoint Presents. I'm Austin Walker. Today, we're going to look at the past and future of gaming. And to do that, we're going to go into blah, 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 blah. Here's the episode with details. And those are called host throws. And even though they only take, like, 30 seconds of the show, you want to do a bunch of takes because you don't know, you know, kind of what the vibe is. Does that make sense?
Well, it's, like, what the vibe's going to be once it's edited. Like, they're figuring out the tone of, like, the arc of the series. Also, like, maybe they'll suddenly find out, actually, we don't have 30 seconds. We have 28 seconds.
We only have 20 seconds. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Or, so a thing that was happening a lot with this one was, We have a couple of episodes where it's like, okay, well, is this going to be the second half of the episode is going to have like a 6 or 7 minute little segment? Is that going to go on episode 7 or episode 8? We don't know. And so you want to do different reads where you do like tonight we show you what it takes to put the finishing touches on two of the most surprising indie hits of last year. Versus like tonight we show you what it takes to put the finishing touches on two of the most surprising indie hits of last year.
It's a lot of like changing like, enunciation of words and like the emphasis. You just do it like a bunch of different times. And sometimes like, you know, when they do ADR, ADR is like, you know, like when they shoot a movie, you know, they go and record dialogue later that they like splice in. I used to do that at G4 when I would do occasional things for X-Play where you'd record things like on set, but then you'd have to go back into a voice studio to like record things because, oh, actually it turns out that we need 15 more seconds, or we got to remove 15 seconds. And so you'd have to like rephrase whatever you were doing or to tell them slice it down.
And so if you've seen Waypoint Presents, which is on Disney XD at 10 p.m. on Wednesdays now, you know that our host throws happen at the beginning of the episode in like the Vice lobby, in like our office lobby, which is like a big open area with a bunch of couches and chairs and stuff where people just work all day because it's a nice, like, it's kind of like a nice relaxed area. But that also means like conversations just kick up every now and then, or Jesus and Mary will come through and they're just like, oh, it's cool that they're there, but like, oh, people want to talk to them real quick. And people, they're very respectful. Like, they'll be like, oh, hey, they're recording, and we throw a peace sign real quick. But other people are like, oh, you know, Jesus, what's good? And it's like, no, they're recording. Or like, just someone like slams a door or like starts to make a really loud, like the loudest iced coffee you've ever heard somehow. So it's just one of those things where it's like, it should only take 20 minutes, but it ends up taking hours.
Yeah.
So Danielle is recovering from her longer host throws. The thing that happened was we got like two or three into mine and then realized like, oh no, this next one is Danielle. Danielle needs to be the one who reads this one. And we thought we were done with Danielle. So we had to like tag back out and switch back around, which you hate to be the bearer of bad news. It's like, Danielle, come back. You can't do the other work that's very important. You have to come do this other work. So just going to be me and you today. And I think we're going to just keep it pretty focused on some Q&A, on some question bucket stuff, because it's been a little while since we've dug through the question bucket. But I just quickly want to see, like, you playing anything? What have you been up to this weekend?
Well, one, because when people listen to media, they listen to more of it up front than the end. So I want to make sure we do the thing that we've been very, very bad at for the last, like, 2 weeks. Is that
we're really bad.
Yeah, we're going to be at PAX. Me, you, Danielle, Danica. Rob is going to be at, I think, a League of Legends thing in Boston. But the four of us are going to be out at PAX Prime for a couple of days. And at Saturday night at 6 p.m. in the
Sphinx Theater, I believe.
I'm looking.
Yeah, it's a Sphinx. I'm on your webpage here at twitter.com/PatrickKlepek, 6 to 7 p.m.
Yes.
That specific time. It's a Sphinx Theater. It says here, the crew behind Waypoint make their PAX debut with a live version of their popular gaming podcast, Waypoint Radio. Awesome. That sounds good. It says we'll have special guests and that we're going to learn about life, love, and anime, especially anime. That's good.
We didn't know if we were going to go to PAX or even if we wanted to do a panel, so I had to write the most generic version of a panel pitch. Actually,
I love it.
My, if you want to be amused for an afternoon, go search through the various. Hopefully, you can actually find. I don't know if they keep the old schedules, because I truly enjoy Jeff Gerstmann's panel write ups that he has.
They're
to
very
write,
good.
For, you know, Giant Bomb does one for PAX East and for PAX West pretty much every year. And he just generically writes this podcast summary, but he does an exceptionally good job of writing a generic podcast summary, which I'm sure he's now at this point written, you know, 25 different times. And he could just copy and paste the same thing, but he doesn't. There's an art to it. There is an art to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, this was from, I think this is from 2020. Maybe this is this year's. I don't know. Giant Bomb is at it again with a lengthy presentation covering the following topics. 1, what's up? 2, what's going on? 3, what's good? Join Giant Bomb for a thorough examination of these important issues and lend your voice to the proceedings via a lively, uncensored Q&A experience that will definitely, quote, get people talking. Good. Great.
Yep.
Perfect.
Very good.
We did one once there that the write-up for it was definitely just like, we're going to figure out what our E3 coverage
yep.
looks like.
I remember that one.
So it's good. Fun times. So yeah, we'll be out there. We'll also just be out there doing some other stuff. Obviously, I'm going to be doing the PAX wrestling stuff.
Yes.
Defending champion.
I'll be in that too.
Professor Killa. You already know what it is. That's good. I'm glad you're going to be there. I didn't know you were going to be part of the old PAX wrestling.
Maybe I'll bring another umbrella.
You should bring an umbrella. You should definitely. We roll deep at Waypoint, so got to bring an umbrella in case we try to make it rain. You know, that's
true.
Because otherwise, it'll be like a hurricane. That's a bad time for the joke. fuck. Shout outs to our listeners, real quick, in Houston and in the Houston area, in Texas, and anyone affected by Hurricane Harvey. I hope everyone's okay. I hope everyone's like doing all right. Natural disasters fucking suck. Houston is a really cool town that I think gets underappreciated in America. Like, I think it just gets swallowed up in the vast, like, oh, it's in Texas, so it must be like everywhere in Texas. But lots of people live in Houston, and lots of people who do really great things. So shout outs to anybody affected by that hurricane. I hope you and your families and friends are all doing all right. All right, we should get to the most important thing. Okay, talk to me about what you've been playing, and then we'll get to the most important email we've received, because it's very important and we have to address
it. I mostly spent more hours with Mario and Rabbids. There's a write-up on the site that is, you know, we don't really do reviews, but it's, you know, 10 hours with with the game. It's actually more like 15 at this point, because I wrote that on Friday. You know, the summary is what I said on Friday. I really like that game. I'm surprised at how well it works. It's very thoughtful and has a decent amount of depth for folks that are interested in those sorts of games. I also think it's a great onboard for those types of games. If you've never played one before, I think they do a really good job of sort of breaking you into the concepts, but then also giving advanced players a lot to work with as it goes along. And specifically, you know, one thing I think I mentioned on Friday was that I was beginning to get more challenged, but I had run into a roadblock. And then over the weekend in World 2, level 8, I ran into my first roadblock where I party wiped like 4 or 5 times in a row.
Did you try doing the easy mode?
No, I did not. I did not do easy mode. So the reason it's interesting is because they occasionally introduce sort of elements in the environment that are out of your control. So, for example, in this one, there's a tornado, and the tornado randomly moves across the map and not only will, like, spring you into the air, but can also do a random chance to, like, freeze you in place. And then also if it springs you in the wrong direction, it can throw you off the board, doing additional damage. And
that doesn't kill you instantly the way it does enemies, though, right?
No. It doesn't kill you. It doesn't kill enemies instantly, but it does do, like, an extraordinary amount of damage.
Okay.
And it changes your positioning. Like, it moves you from whatever behind cover or everything like that.
Which just fucks you up completely, because then everybody else has an open shot.
Yeah, exactly. And it very cleverly, it communicates. So the tornado moves every turn. Every the player and the enemies get one turn, then the tornado moves. And it's communicated by a series of weather vanes that are in the just placed in the map.
Cool.
And so you know where the tornado is going. And so
right.
What's tricky about this is not just the tornado, but that the majority of the enemies that you're dealing with are these enemies that aggro. So they move very slowly. They can only move four spaces. But if you fire on them, they get an extra movement turn. So it's like you can shoot them, but then they can both move four spaces and then move the additional four spaces from their normal turn. Well, the way ideally that you end up dealing with them is that you put two members of your squad on different sides of the map, and you just start drawing them like back and forth. So like you can use their aggro against them in order to kind of like shove them into a position. But you can't ever really do that reliably on this map because the tornado is constantly pushing you into a different position. And on top of that, there are two of these like really annoying support class enemies that they introduce into the other, these like big brutes, aggro brutes you're dealing with, where they can throw grenades and both blow up the cover that's in front of you, heal the enemies that you're trying to take out, when they destroy the cover, they can also like have a chance to cause fire damage to you, which the fire damage then means that you scramble out of the way, like, you know, does the Mario character thing where they grab their butt and they're on fire,
and then they
move like three or four spaces. So you have all of these different elements playing in a very, very tight, contained space where, like, one of my more reliable strategies is to, you know, like set my characters up and go into Overwatch, which is a reaction shot. When an enemy moves, your character will automatically take a shot. And I've upgraded both Mario and Luigi to have double Overwatch, so they can do a regular shot and then two Overwatch shots, which like is usually a really powerful combination, but it becomes useless because in a tight space, if they take those Overwatch shots, they're giving two movement spaces to the aggro enemies.
To the, so that
movement
right, who enemy could now get really close.
Yeah, he can
and
now move 12 spaces.
Up.
And when you have enemies together, they're able to like clamp down and hit two of you at once and bounce you off. So it's I had to completely. It was a lot of chance. I actually had to give up on having all three of them make it out alive. I made it out with two, and they both had one hit left from any enemy that would have taken them out. And then also specifically in that map, There aren't just enemies you're clearing off, and then the board is emptier. It is constantly filling it up with new enemies. Your only goal is to defeat six of them, but you can't just like corner a couple of them, take them out, and then work your way through. It's like the moment if you're not being aggressive and clearing them all off the map as soon as possible, two more are gonna sprout up, and you don't know where they're
gonna
sprout. Yeah, so it's fascinating and difficult.
That seems,
and
is that the final state, the final level in World 2 or something?
No,
or
there's 10 areas per world, and so I'm about to.
But again, you could have gone into easy mode, which would have healed your crew up, and then you would have been able to maybe roll forward, do some more levels that maybe wouldn't be so challenging as they wouldn't have like as difficult gimmicks, and then level up some and come back, unlock better weapons, or like level up is maybe not the right word, because you don't. I guess there's a skill tree. There's a skill tree that can give you extra health
There's a skill tree weapons that have, like, you know, like better chances. Like, some of the weapons will, like, have a 30% chance against, like, mid-bosses, which are, like, a specific boss type prior to get to the final boss. So, you can do easy mode, but I guess the part of what I was worried about was if the missions were going to get, like, really kind of, like, turn the knife on you. And that mission turned the knife in a way that I felt... With satisfying, like, even as much as I like getting the perfects, like you were getting the perfects, there's also, you really desire, like, just getting out by the skin of your teeth. And I felt like I just got out of the skin of my teeth. And so getting out where the game says, hey, you just did good, I was like, actually, asshole, I think I did pretty good.
hey, fuck you.
The fact that I didn't get the perfect doesn't make me feel any less accomplished for getting through it.
That's like when Fire Emblem is at its best. That's how I feel, where it's like all of my dudes are basically dead, but none of them actually died. Yep. Like I stumbled my way through this thing, but I got through it and fuck off, you know, whatever evil wizard guy I was fighting, like the fuck out of here. I played some more of the XCOM War of the Chosen over the weekend, and I'm still fairly early on. Like, I've only just passed where they started to introduce some of the newest stuff in this expansion. Mm-hmm. But some of it's really fucking cool, and it's producing a similar effect for me of the, like, getting through by the skin of your teeth. even though it's also ramping up the kind of abilities that you have. And partially it's doing it because there are more missions that are actually do the thing that Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle does of making you carry over your characters at their current health level from encounter to encounter. Yeah, dude. So they do that in Mario
Rabbids, where it's like, to explain how it works for folks is like,
right,
the individual, like the 1-1, 1-2, like the chapters within a world, like those are often linked by multiple encounters. So it's like there'll be two or three battles you need to survive, and then everyone will get their health back. Often there's a mushroom hidden halfway in that like will give you maybe a third of your health back. And Mario is always the leader, so he is always in your team, so his health is always pretty important because you can't get rid of him. But then once you start to acquire other party members, it's like, all right, Luigi's only got 10 health. I didn't find a health pack. I can bring in Rabid Luigi and hopefully
which is a cool way of making you mix it up, which is really neat. So in this, one of the first examples of that in War of the Chosen, there's a lot of new stuff in War of the Chosen. I know we talked about it briefly before, and you'd mentioned like it almost feels like XCOM 3 in a sense.
Yeah,
like,
my theory was that we're never going to get an XCOM 3, and that they put a lot of their ideas for XCOM 3 into this War of the Chosen. And maybe I'll be wrong, but it just...
My hope is that this does so well that they're able to more fully develop some of these ideas, because some of them are fantastic. So the other thing is like they just have a mission early on that's like, oh, here's all that cool new shit all at once. So the first kind of new thing, big thing, is that there are new factions in the game that there's like three resistance factions that have special soldier types that have different abilities. So like there's the Reapers, who I think eat aliens. That's part of the reason people don't like them, is they eat aliens. It's like, yo, that's kind of fucked up, but they're really good at stealth. They can go back. So I don't even remember if you played much XCOM 2, Patrick.
Oh, but, yeah, I beat it.
Okay, so unlike XCOM 1, for people who don't know, the game in XCOM 2, you're kind of insurgents. You're kind of an insurgent human population trying to fight back against this evil alien empire that's taken over Earth. And every mission starts with you in kind of in stealth, like in cover, setting up an ambush. The Reapers can – not only do they start in cover or in – I forget what their phrase is for stealth, but like – or their term. When they're in stealth, they're way faster, and they get an ability to go back into stealth after breaking stealth, and they also get all sorts of abilities around like setting traps that won't pull them out of stealth, so they can like basically set mines and stuff and then have anybody else on the team shoot the mine to activate it, which is really cool. And then the other faction that's in this early mission is like people who used to be part of Advent, the evil alien, like ground troops, basically. Like they're not high ranking guys, they're just like grunts who have gotten their free will back. And they're like half human, half alien hybrids who are like incredible melee fighters and have grappling hooks and can kind of swing all over the place and do like the scorpion get over here to bring somebody in for a melee hit. And like they're just like badass frontline soldiers, basically.
Right.
And you're trying to like make them meet up. Those two factions meet up and kind of squash the beef so we can ally and fight against the big bads. But it's happening in one of the cities from the first XCOM game that has been fully overrun and corrupted by like this weird alien radiation and has converted a lot of the human all of the human population into zombies, basically, called the Lost, who have very little HP but arrive in huge swarms, arrive whenever you use grenades in a new hive, a swarm will appear, and will overwhelm you with melee attacks and swarm you. But if you kill one, you get an action back, and that means you can then shoot another one. So you're chaining together these headshots, basically, one after the other, But if you have to reload, that's the end of your turn. So it ends up being this really interesting resource management thing where you're like fleeing from this huge swarm of zombies, like trying to stay behind cover. They know where you are, and it's just about managing that stuff.
That seems that would get wild, because there is a there's a skill that does auto reload, which would then allow you to sort of like really do some crazy amount of chaining if you invested in that.
If you do exactly right, yeah. And the other thing is they're a third faction. The aliens are also enemies to them, so that just ends up being this really cool three-way fight at points. But the final thing that they introduce in this opening thing is the Chosen. It's called War of the Chosen because there are these three special enemies that are like orcs from Shadow of Mordor. So like the first one I fought was called the Assassin, and each one is kind of tied to one of the three new resistance factions. She's tied to the kind of alien Advent people called not Templars, but like enforcers or something. I forget the name of them. And they have a procedurally generated name. Hers is Darmai Deseric, which is just a good, good. She's a wraith demon. And then they have strengths and weaknesses just like the orcs did in Shadow of Mordor. So like she's brutal, which means her attacks decrease the will of any soldier in sight. So when she like pops out of invisibility and stabs one of your dudes with her sword, all of the other dudes who see her, all of your other troops, lose will, making them more susceptible to psychic attack from other aliens. And then this is the one that fucked me up, and this should sound familiar. She has Shadow Step, in which she doesn't trigger Overwatch or Reaction Fire. Ooh. So it's just like, fuck, like she's of the alien chosen. She's the one who is probably the physically weakest or whatever, right? She's like an assassin character, but I can't just hole up and go into Overwatch mode. She'll kill me. But she also has weaknesses. One is that she takes extra damage from Reapers, which is one of the things that I got, which is useful. And then two is she takes increased damage from close range attacks. So I was able to fight her, and the whole thing that happened here was like the guy who has the grappling hook, who's half alien or whatever, he got injured down to one HP in the first of this like 3-step phase. Uh-huh. And so the entirety of this final big boss fight against her was just like, all right, I can't let him be out in the open. If he's out in the open, he's fucked. So it was just like very much, very careful management with him between her, the other alien troops, and the Lost, who were like swarming him by the end of it. That was just like, every miss was like a blessing from God. Just like, oh, he missed. They missed him. Thank fucking Christ. Like, I put him in the worst position. And that was really cool. And it was just one of those moments of like, it was cool to see them lean further into the story stuff. It's not what I ever expected I wanted from XCOM.
Right.
It was like more dialogue, or like, I don't know if you saw this in the Polygon has like a review in progress for this game. Okay. And I didn't even notice this until I read this review, but like there are like 4 people from Star Trek The Next Generation in this game.
Okay.
So like which is weird. Like those 2 people are Deanna Troi. You're like Reaper is Deanna Troi, and the alien dude who's like a warrior is just Worf. It's just those 2 actresses or actors and actresses. And it's just like, all right, fucking cool. I'm here for it. I'm here for them leaning into storytelling. I'm here for them doing more cutscenes. There's a bunch of other cool stuff, and I've been really enjoying it. I'm going to try to keep putting some time into it as like my nighttime game.
That bums me out because I want to play that a lot, because all that stuff that you're talking about sounds
it's really cool.
Because I think you saw in XCOM 2 them trying to do some more stuff with the story, uh-huh. but it didn't really work. And like I thought in my head, maybe I'm just not here for that, and that maybe actually what it was they just weren't doing it well.
I think they just weren't doing. I mean, it's very weighty up front. Like I definitely was like, I just want to get into it. You know what I mean? I'm going through all these cutscenes of how they rescue the main character, the commander character, and like just let me fucking play this tactics game. Like I'm just here for the tactics, but. The fact that so to be clear, when you beat the Chosen at the end, she just leaves. She retreats. And it's the same one who will harass you for the rest of the game until you like do the mission to finally take her out. And the same with the other 2 Chosen. And so like between that and then the other new thing is bonds. They added Fire Emblem style. Like these 2 characters have high compatibility, and when they work together, they get special abilities.
Oh, that's good.
Like, it's really good. And like you can spend points in the middle of combat to like. There's a bunch of different stuff that bonds do, but like I think one of the early ones is something about like share, like being able to share your total turns or something like that.
Oh, wow.
There's a bunch of cool stuff like between those 2 characters. There's like just cool stuff around. Those are all systems that, like you said, are things that feel like would be part of a whole new game, and it's cool to see them here at least.
Even if that stuff doesn't end up in an XCOM 3, because I think there's just maybe a little XCOM fatigue. I wonder if maybe what it is like, because I can't imagine they're not going to make another turn-based strategy game. But I'd love for them to take a lot of these ideas. Like I would like a Western Fire Emblem. Basically,
me too.
Right? Like, yep. I think that would be really neat to see them lean in to a lot of the stuff that Nintendo's seen a lot of success with, but, like, taken out of, like, Fire Emblem's fantasy, because, like, they don't seem to be interested in making another Advance Wars, so I'd love to see...
Yeah.
I would love to see that team...
I wish they would do that, too, though. Frankly,
yeah,
I
sure.
would love... What can you do? All right, so... It's time for the question bucket. It's time to dig in. I'm going to pick up with the first thing we got across social media. We got it in our question bucket. Uh-huh. I think I saw someone give me a strange look on the street the other day that probably was about this. This one comes in from Alex, yes, who says, "Hey, Waypoint Radio.
Hello.
I usually love your podcast and insight you bring, but I had a problem with the way you treated Taylor Swift's new single. You're usually very mindful of other opinions, and you all often say things like, 'This isn't for me.' In the case of Taylor Swift, however, you made a number of mentions about how awful her new song is. Taylor Swift is my favorite artist and has been for over a decade, mm-hmm, and it was pretty awful hearing my favorite podcast talk about how terrible my taste in music is and how my favorite artist simply isn't good. Her music isn't for everyone, and I understand that none of you like her new single, but I would respectfully like to ask you all to just be more mindful when you make blanket statements. I'm sure that every time you make blanket statements, there's at least one listener like myself who wishes you hadn't. You're all awesome, but listening to your podcast after I'd literally listened to the single 10 times that morning was pretty demoralizing experience. Thanks for your time, Alex."
Look what we made him do.
Uh-huh. What's up? I think, real talk, I think that you, Patrick, were very clear that you love pop music.
That was like part of my upfront thing. It was like, look, this is not a Taylor Swift bandwagon bash session. Right. I like name checked that people that joined on the 1989 bandwagon are not going to be able to name check Red as an album, right, that they enjoyed. And like, I enjoyed that. So I think this, unfortunately, this fan needs to separate the fact that I think a little what's happening here, which happens a lot. Like, I actually have experienced, mm-hmm, this a couple of times in other mediums other than video games. When you listen to a podcast in which you, by and large, find that your opinions are, like, let's say 95% consistent, yep, with like a little bit of variation, and then you're excited for them to talk about something that means a lot to you, and their opinions do not line up with what you thought they would be, because that tends to be what lines up with what you believe. Like, that sucks. Like, I can't remember the movie, but I was listening to a podcast a year or two ago, and they don't normally talk about like horror films because it's just not their vibe. But like, there was a movie that had come out that had kind of like Get Out, that was like manages to like escape its genre a little bit, right, to be like good, right, enough, like that it's appreciable to an audience that is a little bit larger. And so I was so excited for them to talk about it, because it's like, oh, these podcasters never talk about like this one thing I'm very interested in, and they're going to talk about this one. So it seems like the only reason they'd want to talk about it was because, like, oh, it was like transcendent for them too, and it's going to be interesting. And instead, they just shit on it and like ripped it apart. And I was like, you guys don't. I felt myself doing the "you don't know what you're talking about." Like, I was doing it in my head because I felt insulted that they didn't like the thing that I liked a lot, and I wanted them to validate my opinion on it. But sometimes what you need to do, I understand that impulse, but also, like, that's not really fair. I don't think we blanket stated fans' ability to appreciate Taylor Swift's new song. We were just saying we all thought it was bad.
I think it's bad. Like, the other thing is, like, I want to be clear that there needs to be a space in which critics can say that a thing is bad. Like, I do my best to that, and that doesn't mean that you're not allowed to like it. Like, that is the thing that is complete. Like, I like a lot of anime. I also think a lot of anime is bad. I think there's lots of things that I like, and I'm a little bit torn on this, right? Because I think that there is value in liking a thing that other people think is bad and being able to say, like, oh, actually, here's why I think this is good. Like, let me actually not just call it a guilty pleasure. Let me not just say that it's like, oh, it's like a private shame of mine that I really like XYZ. Instead, let me say, like, I like this thing in spite of these factors, or I actually just don't agree with you that these elements of it are bad.
Right.
But I also need to, as a critic, occasionally be able to put my foot down and say, like, no, I think that this is a poorly made thing. Like, I think that the pre-chorus is so much better than the chorus in that song, and the chorus drives it completely off track. Like, I think that it completely ruins whatever flow that song has as a pop track. And like, that isn't a thing that that's not a blanket statement. That's not like Taylor Swift could never make good music. It's not people who like Taylor Swift are wrong. It's not you're wrong for this thing sounding good to you. It's me saying, like, as someone with a platform, I think she can do better. Mm-hmm. And like, that's just a thing that I can say. And like, it's part of what makes it useful to do criticism, is being able to bring out that gun when you think something really is capital B bad. Like, well, otherwise,
and at some point you need to establish sort of lines of like, what actually is your taste, right? Like, you can't couch everything in like, it's not for me, thus,
right,
it may be good and I just don't understand it. Like, that is often and a lot of times true, and it's good to keep an open mind. It's, you know, it's why I flipped on games like Spelunky and Dark Souls, and I've talked about that a number of times over the years. But, like, there are still, it's still okay to say, I think this thing is bad for XYZ reasons. And that's fine for, as you said, like, the flip of that, but as a critic, like, not only just as a, in a professional capacity for what you and I and everyone else at Waypoint does, but even as a fan, even as just someone, you know, fans have opinions too, and it's okay to, like, draw a line in the sand and be like, I believe X, and that's okay, because other people can believe Y for their reasons, but...
Dragon's Dogma is a good game. This is the other thing is that, like, it goes the other way, which is a lot of people disagree with the things we think are good, but I'm not going to back down from saying that it's good when I like something that I think is, like, does something really well, does something really admirable. I'm not going to back away from that and instead say, well, for fans of the genre, like, fuck that. Like, that's not useful criticism.
That just means that you don't like it. So just say you don't like it.
Right, or that you like it because you like the genre. Like, that's like surface level criticism that can be useful for, like, quick purchasing decisions. But no one was, like, basing whether or not they were going to go buy the new Taylor Swift single on our, like, up or down on this. Right, like, go listen to it for yourself. If you like it, you like it. That's cool. I think it's bad, and I'm you know, I do my best not to say, like, this person makes bad things. But I'm not going to back away from saying, like, this thing is bad.
I actually think our first installment of Waypoint 101, in which we played Binary Domain, a game that you and I liked quite a bit and continued to like when we sort of played through it, and Rob mostly started playing and asking, like, why did you make me do this? And he found things that he thought were interesting about the game, but it was an exercise in where, like, Austin and I were on one side of the room and Rob was very much on the other side of the room wondering what the hell we were thinking. And a lot of our conversations were centered around, in some ways, like, trying to convince Rob, or at least being forced to articulate. Whereas, like, Austin and I can have a shorthand about, like, why we think Dragon's Dogma or Binary Domain is good. But then when you're confronted to talk to someone that doesn't think that thing is good, you're then forced to articulate why you actually think that thing is good in a way that you just don't do when you're talking in sort of a more collectivist atmosphere in which you're all on the same page.
And I've also just gotten, it's also helped me carry that forward in general, right? Like, being able to better articulate why I think games like Dragon's Dogma or Far Cry, you know, 2 are good, why I think that they're good, informed how I would eventually write about Breath of the Wild. Like, I wouldn't have been able to write about Breath of the Wild in the way I was able to unless I'd already worked through why I liked the elements of that game that I'd seen in other kind of open world action RPGs. And, like, being able to do that has a lasting effect in the long run. Also, it just helps you eventually narrow down what you like and don't like as a fan of things, right? Like, being able for me to be able to look at a new anime that's coming out, right? Like, when a new Gundam series is announced, I'm not just all aboard because it has the word Gundam on top, right? Like, I actually am, because I've watched all of these different shows, I can say, okay, what subcategory of Gundam show does this fall into? Is it going to be this kind of big thing where there's, like, super robots who are stronger than every other, you know, mech on the field, the way Gundam wins? Or Double O were, or is it going to be this thing that's a little more restrained, a little bit more of a traditional war story, the way Iron Blooded Orphans or Gundam Wing MS Team are? Obviously, you're with me on this, Patrick. I know.
100%.
It helps you figure out your own taste in a good way. If you can stop and say, this is why I think the new Taylor Swift track is good beyond just I like it, then that's going to help you better understand your own taste. And frankly, like, it just brings me way more joy to, like, sit down and listen to. So, like, when To Pimp a Butterfly came out, my initial reaction was like, I think I like this past Kendrick Lamar album way better. And then I sat down and tried to, like, work through why that was. And I ended up gaining an appreciation for all of his albums in a way I hadn't had before, because I spent the time trying to work through what my gut reaction was. Maybe I could do that with the new Taylor Swift song. Like, maybe I could sit down and be like, this is why I think it's bad, and we'll see what's on the other side. But I think I just get more strange looks on the street.
Yeah.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right, next question. This one comes in from Daniel, who says, "Hi, Vice Media LLC. Mm. I emailed you a few months back, and I'm hoping now is a good time to test our widget below your content or our 300 by 250 unit above the fold on your website. We are currently seeing very high CPM rates for websites similar to yours, and I believe we will outperform your current monetization methods. You can visit this page." I should click this, right, where it says visit. I should definitely click.
Is that going to give you a virus?
It might. It. I'm going to just hit close on this one. I'm going to do a new email, a different one. All right. Let's see. This one comes in from Ken, who says, "Waypoint Radio has been around for a while, so an important question arises. Has fan art been made? Austin as a professor, Patrick as a member of the Newsboy Legion, Rob as Lord Nobunaga, Danielle as not Taylor Swift." Well, there's been some fan art. I don't think that specific collection, but...
No, but yeah, some very good stuff from the Breakfast and Battlegrounds stream.
Fantastic Breakfast and Battlegrounds fan art. You should go check that stuff out. We also got a really good Us as Kingdom Hearts character recently.
Yeah, after the
because
Disney
of the
thing
Disney show.
Yeah. Oh my.
Super, super, super good. Here's a good question. This one comes in from Brian, who says, Brian from Dallas-Fort Worth, who says, "I'd like to ask you about what makes a classic. Today, a lot of games are coming out which try to recreate the success of old classics. Some fail, such as Yooka-Laylee. Some succeed, like Sonic Mania. I don't think it's as simple as recreating exact mechanics faithfully. See the physics of the successful Donkey Kong Country Returns, which have way more momentum than the original games. I think the key is remembering why classic games were classic in the first place, because in their time, they were fresh, innovative, and bold. Too many games simply regress 20 years and think that's good enough. It's not. You have to be impressive on top of that, or you're missing the point of why they were classics. Do you agree that reviving classics requires more than regressing 20 years and changing a few random things? Do you think if a game did perfectly recreate the mechanics of an old game, which attempts like Yooka-Laylee did not, in addition to not trying to impress, it could do so without being innovative?" Brian from Dallas-Fort Worth. Most of these, like, classic in this sense, this sort of, like, building block, foundational game that other games try to relate to or try to improve on, I actually have a hard time reaching back to those games and thinking, like, this is why they were foundational in the way that they were. Mm-hmm. Because I often don't have a close relationship with those games, despite having played them and loved them at the time. Like, I'm not a person who goes back and replay. Like, Dan Reichert replays Link to the Past every year. And I don't think I have a single game I do that with, except for, like, Streets of Rage 2, because I can do that in a night. I have a friend over and we have some beers, let's play through Streets of Rage 2. But that's not the same thing, you know? So I'm actually not sure that I'm super good at being like, this is why this defines a classic for me.
Yeah, I didn't do that even when I had the time to do that. And that's just not how I have viewed games. But I think, like, to the idea of, like, what they were talking about how you sort of create a modern version of sort of like these classic games, and how you, like, Donkey Kong Country is a great example of that, in which Retro, you know, made something very much in the spirit of Donkey Kong Country, but obviously added some different nuances. Like, I think Breath of the Wild is essentially takes in your head what it was like to play the original Zelda, but it's clearly not what, if you were to go back, you'd be like, oh no, I mean, that game was not systemic. That game did not have a lot of the interlocking things that are going on in Zelda 1. But I think if you were to describe the experience of playing Zelda 1 as a kid, Breath of the Wild realizes that in a modern context without pandering to nostalgia in a way that is just sheer pandering. It's actually taking the spirit of what made that game special and recontextualizing it while also paying tribute to the game, the original
game. To that stuff, yeah. I definitely think that's true, especially when you start thinking about, like, you know, we don't think of it as being a systemic game, the original Legend of Zelda, but think maybe compared to something like a text adventure, right, where there is a solution to a puzzle versus getting the raft in The Legend of Zelda, the original one, which is still used in that same adventure gamey way of, like, I'm going to use the raft at this key place to cross the bridge or across the river, but it feels systemic because it's an item I'm using and I could try to use it anywhere, or like using a bomb to blow a hole in the wall, right? Like, I could try to blow a hole into any wall. It's just only going to work in these key places. And that felt at the time more systemic because it was just an inventory filled with items that were just like the sword that I could use whenever I wanted to, whether or not they were successful or not. Whereas now, like, the context has changed, like you said, and so we want a little bit more clarity around that stuff, and we think that, like, systemic interaction should look more like this than what it did, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I think that sort of thing of, like, maybe for me, one of the things that sets a classic apart from other games. I just realized I had a very similar conversation about masterpieces as part of a recent Giant Bomb video I guessed it on. But I think a masterpiece is a different thing than a classic. And I think a classic specifically really does contribute to the canon and to, like, what we think of as, like, a set of standards. Like, the same way that in classic, when you think about a classic film, it's like, oh, these are representative of the best of their era. Like, when you think about, like, 1970s classic films, it's like, oh, this is what's worth remembering from the 1970s. You know, this is what's worth remembering from the 1950s. When you talk about a movie like Casablanca, like, it's not like every movie of that era was a Casablanca. It's like, oh, this gets to represent the best of what filmmaking is like of the 1950s, right? And I think, you know, maybe what, games...
Is a masterpiece just, like, an individual work that stands,
I think,
like,
so. Outside of that, for me, a masterpiece, like, when I think about masterpiece games, I don't necessarily think of them as being represented. I don't know.
I think a masterpiece can, and a classic can also be the same thing, right? Like, I would think...
Totally. Yes,
I would look
at the
original Dark Souls, I think, is both a classic and a masterpiece, probably, right? Like, it informs, like, a certain era of design and was deeply influential, but I think on its own is sort of like a masterwork of in and of itself.
Right. But I think that there are probably outsider art or independent art that is a masterpiece but probably doesn't obtain quote-unquote classic status.
Okay.
Like, classic status really suggests that it's about kind of mainstream work, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it defines what mainstream quality looks like. Whereas I can think of like games like the stuff that, like, the Arcane Kids make, or stuff like Brendan Chung's work, stuff mm-hmm. like that, where it's like, I think those games are I think that, like, 30 Flights of Loving is a masterpiece.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I don't know that it's what people – I don't think that society thinks of it as a classic, which is a fucking problem with society, not a problem with that game. Do you know what I mean?
This is like the equivalent of like everyone falling in love with bands like Weezer and not ever realizing the Pixies existed, where it's like,
right? Yes, exactly. But that even changes over time, right?
Like, right, sure.
10 years from now, we might be in a different place where that is, or, like, I think now the Pixies are at this point a classic because they've kind of found their way into that specific, like, enough people's minds, you know, where people can make that reference. But at the time, no one fucking knew,
yeah.
You know, like, that's yeah. And that's how it works. So I think that's a good distinction. You have time for, like, one more,
yeah.
Patrick? All right, cool. Let's grab this one right here. This one comes in from Alice, who says, hey, Waypoint, with PAX coming up next week, and I'm revisiting a question that gets harder every year. I used to love going to PAX, with both East and West being the highlights of my year. Then in 2013, one of the Penny Arcade creators said some stuff that I found incredibly offensive as a trans woman. At the time, I felt like most of my friends and the discourse were on my side. But now, 4 years later, it seems like everyone, including friends, are just going to PAX again and have moved on. But I haven't. Am I wrong to still hold a beef? I know that PAX is more about the community than about the Penny Arcade creators, but I also know that I cannot willingly attend so long as the con is run by and overseen by those guys. I do not judge anyone who goes now, but I just feel left behind. Any advice for dealing with a situation like this? Love the show and wish Danica was on every episode. Shout out to Danica, who should be on more episodes. If she had more time, I promise she would be.
I think that's a completely reasonable position,
yeah.
But I also understand. I think there are a lot of people, myself included, where there were very serious conversations about should we cancel the panel that, you know,
right.
we had planned. Should we do that panel because we've already announced it, but not do ones in the future? Do you do the panel and then make a statement as a part of it?
Right.
And I think a lot of people had a lot of. Ultimately, like, I remember the conversations we were having at Giant Bomb, like, when all that stuff was happening and we were trying to think through how you handle that was, does canceling and pulling out make a bigger statement than what you're taking away from the fans who have had nothing to do with any of those statements lose right. by having you not go to that.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I think probably somewhat selfishly, that's what a lot of people, that's the side a lot of people fell on. I think there were some people that did like sort of 1 year protests. But then I think specifically when it got sold, that like for a lot of people felt like when Reed Pop took it over, and while the Dragon Ball Z press release in front of me.
Yeah, that one just came in. I was like, ooh, what's going on with the Dragon Ball Z press release?
When Dragon Ball Z took over PAX.
When Goku took over PAX. When Frieza took over PAX. Ooh, it was rough.
When Penny Arcade became just sort of like figureheads, but were no longer financially benefiting. I mean, I guess we don't know what the breakdown of that is. But,
I have no idea.
But I think for some people that felt like that was a conscience clearer in terms of returning to that show. I know a lot of people.
Definitely what I was going to say. That I heard that so many times. Yeah.
Whether or not that is actually true, that was a justification used by a lot of people to feel okay about going back if they had skipped it or attended it, but then were publicly bashing it. And I think now we've just gotten enough distance from that. And those two, while and specifically the one, you know, Penny Arcade figure responsible for those comments, like it just you don't see them as associated with. So I think a lot of people just have kind of accepted that it's an okay thing to be a part of,
or it's just weird.
Part of the cost of doing business is that the amount of good things that PAX does do for communities and for the ability to connect with fans and the inability for a spinoff convention to like spontaneous appear to take its place, like the amount of gravity that would have to be extracted in order for that to occur didn't occur. And if there was a moment for it to occur, it was at that moment and it didn't happen. I don't blame them for saying fuck it and judging people a little bit for going, because I consider.
I mean, they even say Alice even says here that she doesn't judge anybody else for going.
I judge like, myself. I consider myself to be an outright hypocrite for like being the kind of person that would wag their finger and say you shouldn't go to that. But I've gone to PAX 4 years. So I'm going this weekend, but. I think what's important is to recognize your own hypocrisy. That doesn't necessarily excuse you of it, but I've walked through, and I'm willing to admit my own hypocrisy and participation in something that I should be.
It sucks though. Like it is definitely a thing that's hard for me to find peace with myself. Mm-hmm. Like I've only gone for the last couple of years, right? Like I didn't go for years. I never went. I didn't have the experience of like, oh, I'm going and having a good time, and now they fucked up. Like, I definitely always only had the, like, I don't want to go to this thing. I was actually, like, very much the sort of person who was like, I'm not even interested in going to a PAX. And then I ended up going and had like, a really good time and met a bunch of fans and was able to meet other people in the industry and hang out and all that stuff because of work. Because, like, when I went to Giant Bomb, I wasn't going to be in a position where I was going to be like, thanks for bringing me on, guys. Fuck PAX. I'm not going. I'm not going to go meet fans. I'm, like, especially my first year where like meeting fans and trying to win people over who had never known who I was before was such a priority for me in terms of my professional career and even just like for my self-esteem, right? Like it sucks to be new at a place and to be at a place that's so fan driven. Mm-hmm. And like, if I had not gone, that would have been a lot of people whose hands I couldn't have shaken, who's like, who wouldn't have seen my commitment to being part of that crew. The fact that I put all of that above the shitty stuff that those dudes have said and done in the past is like gets at me in a way that even saying that it gets at me feels shitty. Like it's really hard, and it's only gotten fucking weirder for me in the last couple of years. Like I don't think this is a thing I've talked about publicly before, but I've done two tabletop role-playing game streams with Jerry from Penny Arcade in the last year.
Really?
Yeah, so like the first time I had no idea I was going to do it. I'd signed up to do a thing with Adam Coble and some other folks who I knew. We were going to do a stream of this game. I talked about the game actually on an early episode of Waypoint Radio. It was a game called what the fuck is it called? It's I can't believe I forget the name of this tabletop role playing game. It's something dogs. It's like a classic dog Oh my god, this is gonna kill me, and people are gonna
yell at me.
We'll
just keep going, and then...
Anyway, Dogs in the Vineyard, I got it. Dogs in the Vineyard. We talked about it in an early episode of Waypoint Radio, and I didn't know Jerry was gonna be part of it until the announcement went up on Twitter.
Oh, man.
The setup for me was like, someone was like, oh, do you want to do this? And I was like, oh yeah, totally. And he was like, okay, I'm gonna send through an email later with the information about who all is gonna be in the show, and you know, when it's all gonna happen. And that second email never came. And so the thing that happened was, like, I opened Twitter one day, and it was like, oh, Austin Walker, Jerry Holkins, a couple of other people are all going to be part of the stream. And it was like, all right, cool. Huh. I could drop out of this. I could back out. But that seems like shitty to the person who I agreed to, who wasn't in charge of promotion. You know what I mean? Like, I agreed to one person and a different person was in charge of promotion and, like, dropped the ball and letting me know. And so I ended up saying, like, fuck it, I'll do it. Like, I'm not going to go out of my way to promote it. Because I still have some really, even though Jerry isn't the person who said the most offensive shit years ago, I still have always felt like really fucked up over it. Like, I grew up loving that dude's work. Like, I grew up wishing I was Jerry Holkins in terms of my writing style, in terms of like my verbosity, in terms of my reading interest. And so when they fucked up, like, it really, it hurt me in a way that, like, couldn't have been not comparable to trans folk and other people who they hurt, you know, sexual assault survivors, stuff like that, who's like, they were so dismissive of, that it's still to this day makes me very angry. But I was still disappointed. And so, like, I went through that game, and the fucking most, the most frustrating thing is, he and I had really good chemistry, right? Like, he and I played off of each other super well because I grew up reading his shit. So, of course we did, right? Like, in the same way that, like, Vinny and I have really good chemistry because I watched a billion Giant Bomb videos. Like, I knew exactly how to play off that dude. And so we had a really good rapport. And then at the end, it was like this sort of like, okay, now what? And like, nothing. Like, I'm going to go back to work. Now what? Like, that's what happens. And then it happened again a couple of months ago where we ended up in the same game again. And it was like, okay, like, we're going to do it again. And we're again going to have a really good time. But I'm in this weird position where I don't, it's not my place to squash that beef, because otherwise it feels like I'm throwing away a value that I have in exchange for professional gain. And like, I don't need it right now. Like, I'm doing all right. Like, 5 years ago, maybe that would have been a very tempting thing to do. Mm-hmm. But now, like, I feel like I have to, like, hold that grudge a little. Not even a grudge. Like, I hope that dude has a happy life. I hope he has, you know, I hope his kids are great. I'll play games with him. But, like, I there's a point at which I have to feel like I draw a line somewhere. And I don't know what the way forward there looks like. There's some weird small part of me, Patrick, that's like, just put me in a room with him and I can like show him the error of his past ways. He's the chosen one, you know, like, I can save him. And that's silly. And it's like childish. And instead it's just like, I have to live the best life I can. And I think that for a lot of people who have that thing with PAX, I think, like, come to terms with it internally, talk to your friends who are sexual assault survivors, who are trans folk, and like, see what their opinion is on this, but not in a way that don't ask them for permission. Like, don't ask them for forgiveness in advance. Do you know what I mean? Like, really, like, ask them about what they think about those dudes and where they're at. And then do the balance yourself, do that calculation to yourself and see what you're comfortable with. And I think, like you said, Patrick, like, to some degree, really hold yourself accountable, really work through what your personal feelings are on that situation and other similar ones. Like, I don't know. There is no ethical consumption or capitalism. There are lots of – every day we do things that hurt people, every day nonstop. And that's not an excuse to do whatever you want. It's for me, it's a call to action to find places in which you can prioritize and take action in places that will at least have some effect. Where can you make the biggest impact? Where can your presence or your absence really communicate something? And like, in your personal life and your professional life, what are the things you can do to help the communities that you care about, right? Which is like, for me, as an editor, I've always wanted to try to raise marginalized voices from groups that I'm not part of, right? Like, obviously, every time I write something, that's a black dude in America writing something, you know, for a wide audience. But I do my best to bring in, you know, queer writers, trans writers, to bring in people from other racial minorities, to raise the voice of women in America, and, like, to help people in this community who don't otherwise have platforms. That's me doing my best to be an active participant, so that when I have to be this shitty, passive person who winds up at a PAX, like, I at least feel like I'm doing something to help the communities and not just kind of like grinning and bearing it and saying, oh yeah, I guess I fucked up again. Like, so maybe find something, if you do find yourself going to PAX, find something in which it doesn't even out. It's not like a one-to-one thing, but find something where you can at least say, here are ways in which I'm specifically helping communities also. That was a long spiel. I didn't mean to go all off the rails like that, but got to get it all out sometimes, Patrick.
Yeah, no, it was a really good question. That's
a great question. Thank you so much.
I also think it's been long enough that some people might not even be aware any of that stuff happened.
Yeah,
Guys have kind of stayed off the radar.
Yeah, I mean, they still do like the Omegathon. They still like host the keynote, right? Like,
but I mean,
still
sort part of like, of that so, event. Like they used to be. I felt like Panarchy used to be more part of the social consciousness.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
What they said resonated on a day to day basis. Yeah. And what they thought about games meant a lot, and that just doesn't seem to be the case. That might be part of the reason people don't think about it as
that's
much
actually
or,
a good point
or hold themselves to account about the hypocrisy, because in some ways it's like who gives a fuck about Penny Arcade anymore. like and I don't mean that to be like extraordinarily dismissive. I just mean it's not the cultural touchstone that it used to be,
right? Which is strange. Like it's just so strange to me that like I was in high school reading that comic, and I know there are people who are still in high school who read that comic.
Sure.
Right, like their forums are still super active, those conventions are still filled with people who like to get PA merch, you know, and swag and all of that. But it's like, I think that comic specifically makes me think a lot about games culture on a timeline in a way that other things can't, because it's been those two dudes for decades now. And that's wild, you know, or 15 years, 20 years. Like, I don't know how old that comic is at this point, but it's getting there. It's getting to be old the way like comics get old. Mm-hmm. And that's games, man. We're living the life, and it's weird to be part of it at this point, given that like, I think you and I can both think so clearly of a time when we were both very young and just itching to be part of it, and looking at things like Penny Arcade as like, wow, people who go in through non-traditional routes can have some impact in this community. So it's weird. I think that's going to do it for us, Patrick. If you're listening and you want your question to get read, you can send it in to gamingadvice.com. Use the subject question in the title, or question bucket, or questions. Those questions in there, it should show up. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Patrick?
This was a nice, short 55-minute podcast.
Yeah, we fucking sure did the thing. Your wife isn't waiting for you to go pick her up at like a train station, right?
No,
you already
she
did
is
that?
Not. I would have stopped. I would have stopped.
Okay, good.
But yeah, you can find me at Patrick Kluppen.
And you find everything we do at twitter.com/waypoint, at facebook.com/waypointvice. Come to the site at waypoint.vice.com. Visit us on YouTube at youtube.com/waypointvice. And come to our PAX panel. One more time. When and where is that, Patrick?
Saturday, 6 p.m., Sphinx Theater.
Sphinx Theater, come check it out. We'll be there. We'd love to meet you all afterwards, during. We'll shake some hands and answer some questions. We still, Patrick, we should have a meeting about what that panel looks like.
Yeah, we'll think about it.
We'll think about it. Shout out to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Payoff Machine. You can find out more info about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Friday, I don't know what we're going to do for a podcast on Friday, Patrick.
Well, I think we're going to see if we can't get something official from PAX, if we can't like bring a nice recorder and get some.
Yeah, and maybe do some
Of that podcast we record on Saturday. If not,
and then
maybe
turn that around for the weekend.
I don't know. Maybe we'll get together. You know, we'll have gone on Friday. Maybe we'll you know do 10 minutes from the show floor while we're
yeah or something. We'll figure something. I'm gonna bring
having dinner and stuff like that. So
I'm gonna bring a decent recorder. So maybe we'll just be able to find a hallway and knock something out at least. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll be back later this week. Peace.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.